This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
If they continue to criminalize it, they'll kill the economy. Go to the fast food industry. It's not all right. People are charging in the U.S. and the government is allowing it.
That's economic analyst Gif Mugano on plans to bolster Zimbabwe's sagging local currency by establishing penalties for using U.S. dollars. Details coming up also. A massive attack by Islamic militants in the Sahel region leaves 71 soldiers dead, and thousands of protesters hit the streets of Algeria's capital today during the country's presidential election. We have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Niger President Mahamadou Issoufou has rushed home from a trip to Egypt in the aftermath of a massive attack by Islamic militants that left 71 soldiers dead. It was the latest, boldest, and deadliest assault on remote military outposts in the Sahel region. It likely involved weapons and vehicles that were taken in the previous attacks. French President Emmanuel Macron postponed next week's planned meeting with five presidents from the Sahel on security in the region. It has been pushed back to early next year. The attacks have escalated despite the presence of 4,500 French troops and the 13,000-man UN force in the Mali, MINUSMA. The defense minister said many hundreds of well-armed attackers were involved in Tuesday's attack. In addition to the dead, another 12 Nigerian soldiers were injured and an unknown number were missing. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but Boko Haram and Islamic State are active in the area 30 miles from Oualem. More than 230 soldiers in Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso have been killed in the past 4 months, along with 13 French troops in a helicopter collision while chasing jihadists. Mali's military has closed some of its most isolated and vulnerable outposts as part of a reorganization. Authorities in Cameroon say Boko Haram terrorists have been launching daily attacks on villages along the Nigeria border, killing at least 30 people and injuring scores in the past few months. A high-level security meeting has recommended that traditional rulers, the clergy, and civilians work with the military to help reduce the attacks. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more from Mora, Cameroon.
55-year-old cattle rancher Lamsi Gudjo, speaking through an interpreter, asked for temporary housing at the central mosque in the town of Mora on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. He says Boko Haram militants attacked his ranch in Wewak village on Tuesday, and it is still not safe for him to return. Gudjo says as he went to negotiate with cattle buyers, Boko Haram terrorists attacked his ranch, probably thinking that he had collected money for the animals. He says when his wife and neighbors saw the fighters and alerted him of the danger, he escaped on his motorcycle. Wewak villagers told Gudjo that Boko Haram killed 5 people in the attack. The governor of Cameroon's far north region, Mijiyawa Bakari, says the attack on Wewak was just one among 100 they have recorded in the past 3 months. At a high-level security meeting Wednesday in the city of Marwa, Bakari said the Boko Haram attacks left at least 30 people dead in villages around Mora, Tokombere, Limani, Kolofata, and Ashikashia.
Avec l'arrivée de la saison sèche, nous connaissons des incursions.
Bakari says with the arrival of the dry season 3 months ago, incursions by Boko Haram terrorists from Nigeria into Cameroon have been increasing. The fighters can now infiltrate through areas that were marshy or waterlogged along the porous border during the rainy season, he says, but have since dried up with the dry season heat. They have invited local militia groups, traditional rulers, and the clergy to work with officials for an immediate military intervention. Bakari says Boko Haram fighters usually step up their attacks at the end of the year when cross-border traffic increases so they can steal supplies. But 26-year-old teacher at the Mora government school Therese Dudu blames the attacks on the absence of Cameroon military in the villages. She says the troops left just months ago, claiming they were no longer needed because peace had returned.
Si les militaires étaient suffisants, cela pouvait mettre fin.
She says they would not have been suffering from apparently ceaseless Boko Haram attacks if the military had remained in sufficient numbers. It is imperative also for people to denounce Boko Haram suspects who are infiltrating the villages, says Dudu, when they are left unprotected. Swaibu Issa is a researcher on Boko Haram at the University of Marwa. He says Boko Haram's firepower has only been weakened, but its fighters are still a threat along the border.
The engagement, the commitment of our political authorities is clearly defined that no matter the cost, they want peace. It is their duty to protect civilian populations. It is their duty to fight those who are not willing to go for peace. The two processes always go together in a war.
Boko Haram terrorists have been fighting for a decade to establish an Islamic caliphate in Nigeria's northeast and began attacks inside Cameroon in 2014. The Islamist insurgents have killed more than 27,000 people and displaced 1.8 million since 2009. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Mora, Cameroon.
Tens of thousands of protesters hit the streets of Algeria's capital today during a presidential election that the transitional government hopes will quell such demonstrations against the political elite. The protesters want new faces, but all five of the presidential candidates have ties to the entrenched establishment, including two former prime ministers. Turnout appeared to be low, and activists stormed a polling station in Algiers, briefly stopping the voting. Unrest also erupted in the northern mountain region of Kabylie, home to much of the country's Berber minority, and security forces used tear gas on crowds that surrounded a government building in Tizi Ouzou. In Algiers, a strong security presence that included water cannons and helicopters was aimed at a repeat of protests yesterday when at least 10 activists were arrested. The winner of the twice-postponed election will replace President Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who ruled the North African nation for 20 years until his resignation in April amid mass protests. The chief of staff of the powerful army, Ahmed Gaid Salah, insisted the vote is the only way to avoid the kind of chaos that engulfed Algeria during its 1990 civil war. You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Fourteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Niger President Mahamadou Issoufou has rushed home from a trip to Egypt in the aftermath of a massive attack by Islamic militants in the Sahel region. And thousands of protesters hit the streets of Algeria's capital today during the country's presidential election. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The Zimbabwe government is enacting a law to criminalize the use of the U.S. dollar. Adigando gives us more on the issue.
The government recently issued an amendment to several monetary acts that calls for a civil penalty for anyone who tries to re-dollarize the economy. The multi-currency system was abolished in June and the local currency was reintroduced as the sole legal tender. It has, however, been devaluing due to a shortage of foreign currency on the official market and general market lack of confidence. With inflation hitting hard, observers say businesses have been raising the prices of their goods and services according to fluctuations in their foreign currency rates in order to retain value as a result of the Zimbabwe dollar devaluing daily. Businesses have been leaning on the U.S. dollar, effectively re-dollarizing the economy in order to stay afloat. Economic analyst Gift Ngano says the Zimbabwean dollar has been rejected by the market and that criminalizing the use of the U.S. dollar defies logic. Ngano says government has no power to control the market and the current move amounts to self-sabotage.
And the worst thing is that this economy is 80% in the formula, which is already using US dollars without any apology. So which economy are they talking to? You can't then say you want to criminalize the 10 companies which are blue chip companies, yet the whole economy is dominated by informal sector which is using US dollars. So you need to be real. The money lost its value. The store of value, which is one of the key functions of money, is not holding. That's why money is being rejected.
Mugano says government has no power to control the market and the current move amounts to self-sabotage.
If they continue to criminalize it, they'll kill the economy. Go to the fast food industry. It's not dollarized. People are charging in the U.S. and the government is allowing it under the Tourism Act. Look at the attempts by government to justify the charges in foreign currency for electricity and some duties.
Mugano believes that policy inconsistency and command economics are hobbling economic progress. Economic analyst Prosper Chitambara concurs.
So it's a bit inconsistent for government to criminalize it, while on the other hand, they are also allowing it for certain groups. Number one, it creates uncertainty. Command economics doesn't really work. What you need is dialogue with key stakeholders and to allow the market to play out. There are a lot of market and structural distortions in the economy that then give rise to rent-seeking and speculative behaviors and tendencies.
Chitambara says the market distortions and the volatile economic policy environment are triggering capital flight. He cites the example of South African clothing retail chain Pepco recently pulling out.
Already watching what's been happening, some businesses have actually been closing shop. So businesses will then respond by undertaking austerity, cost-cutting, which in some cases will involve a divestment. We need to adopt an anchor, a more stable anchor currency. That's my view. So what then happens when you have your own local currency? It becomes difficult for government to be disciplined.
Mugano believes that government needs to revert to the U.S. dollar to enable it to meet its obligations.
These are desperate times to get foreign currency as government because they also need to meet those minimum requirements which are required to give that service which the public is waiting for. What do you then expect of any company which is into manufacturing? Why can't I be allowed to get foreign currency if the government has also the same appetite for same foreign currency?
In abolishing the multi-currency system, government argued that a country cannot grow its economy sustainably without having its own currency. Analysts, however, say that printing money is disastrous in an economy that is not growing and is beset with financial indiscipline. Most citizens still find it hard to get cash from the formal banking system, forcing them to go to the parallel market and triggering inflation and speculative behavior. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo.
Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok says Sudan now has 5,000 troops in Yemen, down from a peak of 15,000. Sudan has been involved in Yemen's civil war as part of the Saudi-led coalition that has been fighting Houthi rebels since 2015. Naba Mohadin has more details from Khartoum.
On Monday, Prime Minister Hamdok said Sudan has reduced its troop strength in Yemen by two-thirds to just 5,000 troops, and he said no military solution can solve Yemen's crisis. Political analyst Khalid Al-Faki said Sudan leaders see little need for further involvement in the war. He says the internal developments Yemen is seeing requires the fast withdrawal and decrease of Sudanese troops in Yemen. It's also compatible with Hamdok's government approach of not participating in any regional or international wars. The conflict in Yemen erupted in 2014 when Houthi rebels took control of the capital, Sana'a. 1 year later, then-Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir sent troops to support a Saudi-led effort to restore Yemen's legitimate government. 5 years of war have left tens of thousands of people dead and hundreds of thousands more displaced from their homes. The Saudis and Houthis have been holding informal peace talks, although fighting continues. Former Sudanese Army Lieutenant Abdurrahman Mohammed says Sudan is following the Arab coalition's lead. He notes that in July, the United Arab Emirates also reduced its troops' presence in Yemen and withdrew heavy weapons. Muhammad says when those troops went to Yemen, it went under Arab coalition request. Sudan agreed to help the coalition at that time. And now, after a while, the coalition saw that making an agreement with Houthis, it states that the two sides should reach an agreement instead of the war. The decrease shows the seriousness of the coalition and Sudan to solve the problem. Sudan's new transitional government, formed in August, is attempting to end all of Sudan's wars, both internal and international, as the country tries to move on from Bashir's 30-year rule. The United States has agreed to restore full diplomatic relations with Sudan after more than two decades, but is still listing Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism. Nabah Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Rwanda and Qatar have signed three agreements setting up a joint venture to build, own, and operate the new international airport in the Bugesera district of eastern Rwanda. Rwanda will hold a 40% stake in the project, and Qatar will have 60%. Ugenwi Mana has more from Kigali.
The three deals are a shareholders agreement, a share purchase agreement, and a guarantee for indemnity. Clever Gatete, Ghana's Minister of Infrastructure, says the Qatar Airways' expertise is needed to build a first-class airport on international standards.
At this time, we are bringing it now to another level. In other words, the first phase will be able to be sufficient to cater for 7 million passengers. And the second phase will be 14 million passengers.
The Bugesera International Airport has been under construction since 2017. The Portuguese construction company Mota Engil has been building it and had held 75% of the project. But the Rwandan government bought up all those shares to transfer a 60 stake to Qatar Airways. The new airport, once completed, will have a passenger terminal covering 30,000 square meters with 22 check-in counters, 10 gates, 6 passenger boarding bridges, among others. Infrastructure Minister Gatete says more airlines will be able to operate in Rwanda because of the size of the new airport.
Even all the other airlines, which have not been coming because of the nature of our airport, will be coming to Rwanda because we'll be having a first-class this time airport, and then interlinking with the whole all the continent will be much easier.
Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani joined Rwandan President Paul Kagame to witness the signing ceremony for the airport project. The Rwandan government says the full project will be done by 2032 at a total cost of $1.3 billion. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
As Kenya marks the anniversary of its independence from British colonial rule, two communities in the Great Rift Valley are asking the United Nations to investigate a colonial-era land grab. The Kipsigs and the Talai communities accuse the British of collective punishment by forcibly evicting them from their land, which was turned into profitable tea farms. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Kericho, Kenya.
Every year, on December 12th, Kenyans celebrate the day in 1963. Their country won independence from British colonial rule. For 1 month, 95-year-old Kibore Cheruiyot Ngasura, there's nothing to celebrate. Ngasura was forced out of his home in 1934. He remembers the scene of this day.
The day of eviction, armed men working for the British administration came and pushed us out of our homes by force, he says. Women whose husbands were jailed were raped. They beat everybody. It was a chaotic day. Ngasura Childhood Home is in Kenya's Great Rift Valley town of Kericho, which is famous for tea farms, most of them owned by rich families and global farms. More than 100,000 people from Kipsigis and Talai community are demanding compensation from the British government. They say British forcefully took their ancestral land more than 80 years ago. In September, the claimants asked the United Nations to investigate. Lawyer Joel Kimutai Bosek is one of the lawyers representing the two communities.
Our argument is they started a form of apartheid in Kericho, and our argument is that the world need to know of all these things. Our argument is, much as we are very concerned, very bitter, and very much and very strongly coming out as people who were oppressed, we are also saying that we are reasonable enough, and they should be reasonable.
The British Foreign Office has said it will respond accordingly to any UN investigation. Kenya's Land Commission in February ruled, despite colonial laws to the country, that the British unlawfully seized the land. Tea companies are challenging the ruling in court, though, to prevent a takeover by the county government. The ruling is expected in January. Kericho County Governor Paul Chepkwony told VOA they are using legal means to deal with colonial injustices meted on his people.
These people don't want to chase away investors. This is something I need to make very clear. But they know that these investors are doing honest business, but in stolen land. And they want to discuss how they can be remedied so that they can live harmoniously with the investors.
Meanwhile, aging claimants like Ngasura only hope to live long enough to see justice, or at least, he says, to hear the British apologize. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Kericho, Kenya.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Patrick Daya, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
It's summertime in the Southern Hemisphere, but if you're north of the equator, border crossings will bring you some warmth with our Psychedelic Sunshine Show. You'll hear from the best Californian musicians of the 60s, like Sonny and Cher, The Monkees, and The Beach Boys. Tune into Border Crossings on December 19th for the grooviest songs in the world, only on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.